Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Rapido.
Good morning. How are you this fine morning?
Great. Now, we've been trying to set aside themes for what is our theme for today?
That's a good question. I'm not really sure that everything's exactly oriented together, but it's a very interesting bunch of people. First of all, an absolutely outstanding restaurateur called Barbara Lynch from Boston. She has
seven or eight or nine
places. She came to our attention because of a wonderful cookbook that she just produced, but she turns out to have a fascinating life story and a great group of restaurants that you're not going to want to miss when you go to Boston. And then we follow that up with places to eat on a budget in New York City, but in interesting fashion in New York City.
Bromberg Brothers.
Yeah, and then at the end of the program, we're going to end with a flavor of France. And we'll explain that closer to the time. We'll explain what that means.
But we forgot about our kitchen. Nuts in the kitchen, too. We got her.
No, that's the French connection. She called us all the way from France, remember?
Oh, right. I thought you meant the connection with the speciality.
Well, that's why I put them together.
Oh, I
They're
see.
Both kind of froggy.
I don't know how I
both a little, both a little froggy. Anyway, let's get down to business, first of all, with fabulous Barbara Lynch from Boston.
We're talking to Barbara Lynch, ostensibly because she finally has this wonderful cookbook out called Stir, Mixing It Up in the Italian Tradition. But we're talking to her also because she's one of the most dynamic chefs in Boston, or in fact in the country, but she happens to be in Boston. Welcome to On the Menu, Barbara.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Ann.
Everything I read uses this phrase that you are an embodiment of the American dream. Maybe you could explain that for our listeners.
A few years ago, the media said that I had my own Good Will Hunting story. It's like the classic local girl makes good against all odds, I guess. I could have gone to a whole other direction. I grew up pretty much by a single mom, and she had seven kids.
Oh, wow.
I was the last Lynch, and then her husband died like a month before I was born. So I kind of grew up without a dad.
Oh, wow.
And she worked tons of jobs. So,
you're what would be called a Southie, right?
Yes. Yep.
So you didn't even know I knew that.
I know.
I read a lot. I used to read a lot of Spencer.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. Sadly, Robert Parker just passed away. But there are only two more books left that he'd already written.
When did he pass away?
About 3 or 4 months ago. I just read the last Spencer. I don't think there are any more Spencers.
Oh.
I just loved it. He just made your part of the world come to life.
Oh.
Didn't you think so?
Yeah. He was great.
And he was probably a customer at your restaurant, too.
Oh, totally. Yeah, he lives right in Beacon Hill.
Came out of nowhere and ended up this very successful chef, right?
Yeah, I came from a housing project as well, so my mother worked, I want to say, like 3 or 4 jobs just to keep us off welfare, but, you know, she wasn't a cook by any means, but she just made sure that we had 3 meals a day. And
I love success stories like this.
I know.
I mean, you were totally self-taught, right?
Oh, God, yeah. Totally self-taught. I was a horrible student as well in high school. I was a little bookie in high school. Now that I think back, I was like this really young entrepreneur, whether it was delegating or making money here and there in different ways. I can't tell you half of them, but I at least tell you the bookie. Playing the dogs and the horses and the lottery and actually taking numbers in high school from my teachers was a lot of fun for me.
I don't think the statute of limitations has expired, we hope.
Exactly.
Well, you know, you have this kind of gritty reputation, but your skills are absolutely amazing, your culinary skills and your business skills.
Yeah. God knows how I did it, but it's still working.
Well, what made you want to be a chef?
I worked at a private club when I was younger. My mother had worked there forever, and I used to go there after high school. I'd cut out of high school a little early and go and work.
Uh-huh.
Or go and make beds. And, you know, this incredible chef, Mario Bonello, was just making people happy by cooking food. And, you know, it wasn't just people. These are world-renowned people. And it was sort of like a private men's club or a private club in Boston. And it was just, I was just amazed at what he was doing and saw people being nourished by him. And I that's when I decided I want to be a chef.
Oh, that's
totally
great.
Wanted to be a chef. And I never thought I'd get this far. Honestly, I thought I'd own a sub shop or a steak chip joint in South Boston.
Now, the other thing everyone says about you is that your cuisine is a combination of Italian influence, French inspiration, and New England practicality with some South Boston attitude. That pretty well sums it up, but could you elaborate on that?
It's basically, I guess Italian was the first food that I actually fell in love with. I had a chance to go over to Italy, and I absolutely fell in love with the culture. I mean, you're talking to a kid who never left South Boston, and here I am on this international flight. I arrive in Milan, and, you know, I was amazed that nobody spoke English. I was like, oh, my God, I'm so screwed right now.
How did
I have no
you
idea where I'm
that
going.
Trip?
I worked next to a girl in Garmage whose mother had a house in Tuscany. She had a little house in a town called Teverina, and she invited me to go. So I said, sure.
Yeah, why not? Why not, right?
Why not, right? I mean, I had to borrow a friend's credit card because I didn't have a credit card. It was just this wild experience. And she was a student at RISD at the time, so there was a lot of RISD students there, artists or wanting to be artists.
That's a Rhode Island School of Design, for example.
Exactly, yeah. And so there were just a bunch of us that were staying at her house, and we made pasta every day. We went to the farmer's market. It was just incredible. Her mother is actually Nancy Harmon Jenkins. And
oh,
so,
is that who it was? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so there was a lot of food influence there. And we actually...
I would say so.
My friend Sarah got hired to do some photography for Faith Willinger at the time. I think she was doing a little cookie book or something, so we would...
Oh, there you go. So you were connected in with the right circle of people.
Exactly. Not even knowing. I mean, God, you know. And then I just felt like cooking was natural for me. I really loved being in the kitchen. I didn't really like waiting on tables or anything. I don't know what it was. I knew when a piece of meat was done just by the way I could smell it, like, coming out of the oven. You know, I just... Very natural.
Well, you write one of the tips in your book, and your book is sprinkled with interesting tips, is no tongs, or worse to that effect, because you like to get closer to food and tongs enable you to stand away from the food. So
yeah.
I guess that's really consistent.
Yeah, it's true.
I have a photograph of Elena Arzak at one of the world's top 10 restaurants in San Sebastian, tasting from a spoon in the kitchen.
Yeah. Oh my God! Isn't
she
amazing?
I'm sure you do exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
She's wonderful, and she does the whole thing too. I mean, she's the family to deal with, and you know.
Yeah, but she's right. But she's right on the line, tasting in a spoon.
Oh, yeah.
Not worry too much if a couple of drips that have been on her lips drop back in the saucepan either.
Right. No, she's amazing. I'm in a group with them. It's called Les Mères Cuisinaires, and we've done a few dinners together, which is great.
Really?
Oh, great, Dad. Do you know Carme Ruscalleda?
No, I don't.
No, she's another lady you should get to know if you ever have a chance to go to either Spain or Japan.
Yeah, oh great, I will.
So where did the mothers meet? I mean, where do you do this?
It was formed by Ariane Daguen, who owns D'Artagnan.
I know.
And yeah. So we met in Paris a few times, cooked over there. We met in New York, cooked for 10 days here. Now we're all a little bit busy, so we have no idea when we're all going to get back together again. But there was Anna Sophie Pick, Elena Arzak, Elena DeRose, Lee Linster from Germany.
The others, I mean, that's top.
Carme needs to be a member of that group. She really
right.
does.
You'd
she
love
would,
her. She's also
You would love her, and she would love all of you guys, I'm sure.
Right. Yeah, it was just basically to like promote women in the kitchen over there in Europe, where it's harder.
Now, you've got a series of restaurants in Boston. Why don't you just run down that list for us so that everyone knows where to go next time they're in Beantown?
Oh, great, yeah. Well, I would suggest that you start at B&G Oysters, which is my oyster bar, and all seafood, so it's always fun to have like a couple of dozen oysters and some great muscadet. And then right across the street is my butcher shop, and it's called The Butcher Shop. And that's all meat. You can have pâtés and terrines and charcuterie. Also, we are a full-on butcher, so we sell mainly farm-raised or primal cuts, anything, sweetbreads, rabbits, plus, you know, prime ribs, sirloin, etc.
Have you ever done your own butchering?
Oh, yeah, I'm a butcher, so we do all our own butchering. We actually have all female butchers, which is fun.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, there's a big bandsaw, so we're sawing to order, grinding to order. It's awesome. And then next to that is my little cooking school demonstration kitchen called Stir.
Which is the title of the book.
Yep. And then up the street from there on Beacon Hill is my first restaurant, Number 9 Park. So I suggest you go there and sit at the bar and have a tasting menu if you'd like. And that's where the prune stuffed gnocchi is. That's
one of your signatures, right.
Yep. And then just across town, not too far, like 7-minute walk or whatever, is my new one, Sportello. It's like my Italian diner.
Oh,
and
yes.
Then downstairs is a bar called Drink. that's what you do, craft of a cocktail, drink. And next to that is the new fine dining restaurant called Menton, M-E-N-T-O-N.
And that's on the French Riviera, but almost in Italy, correct?
Right, it's the Franco border.
There we go. See, I was right.
Yeah.
Oh, it's great. It's a beautiful country. I mean.
So all of in a way, the cuisine at all of these restaurants is represented in your book.
Right. Yep.
And what drove you to open this? And with you have so much on your plate, what drove you to open your fine dining restaurant? Economic times, particularly.
Yeah, but this was a decision I made 5 years ago before the economic times.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just this part of the city. It's kind of, I grew up 5 minutes from here, and I always loved it. So I actually just decided to take the 15,000 square feet. Boston is in need of another fine dining restaurant, you know? It's definitely needed, and I figured, why not? I'll have a casual one, a bar, and then a fine dining restaurant.
Yeah, you've covered all bases, right?
I have covered all bases. And now, quite frankly, I feel like I've come full circle. Like, when you read in my book, it talks about, like, how when I got married and I went to all the Michelin star restaurants in Paris for lunch, and spacious and grandiose and luxurious, the number 9. So now I feel like I'm complete. I'm not sure I need to open another restaurant.
I was going to ask you, you're probably full up at this point, right?
I think I am. I think I'm done.
Perhaps your husband had something to do with it, too. He's probably finally getting you to slow down just a little bit.
As soon as I get him to slow down, I'll slow down.
You said he was kind of laid back. You have a little tribute to him at the beginning of the book.
Yeah, he's a little laid back.
So
he's a great husband. I have a 6-year-old daughter, so he spends a lot of time with her, too.
Do you have only one, or you have more?
I have 3 stepchildren from him, his children, plus I have my own one.
So inside the book, you're organized in a relatively conventional sort of start at the front and the end of the menu, end at the back end of the menu with sweets. But in between, what's represented is a range of recipes that are designed for the home cook to be able to make, but based on what happens in your restaurants. Would I say that right?
Yeah.
So even I could make them.
Oh, totally, totally.
You don't know how well I cook.
Well, I mean, I think there's a few challenging recipes, like the prune stuffed gnocchi is definitely going to be a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
But I think break it down, so maybe make the sauce first and get used to that, and then make the pasta and freeze it. It's kind of, I don't know. I get a lot of emails saying, oh, my God, we're doing 5 dishes out of the book this weekend. They're delicious. And so you take on whatever you want to take on. That would be my plan.
Now, how did you decide where the tips sort of belong? Because they really range all over. You have making sure you buy dry scallops so you don't get that horrible, milky, soppy stuff all through the pan.
Right.
But then later on, something I wouldn't necessarily have thought about, you have advice on buying short ribs. Take us through that example just to give people an idea of the wisdom that's in here.
Well, is it the way I... What's so different? Is it the way I have it cut, like the 12 inches, or...?
I'm not sure. I didn't read every word of it. I thought you'd probably remember.
It's
so you'd
called
be able
buying
to say.
Short ribs.
It's called buying short ribs.
I think it's more or less the cut. Yeah, you want
say
a nice...
There are two ways that they could be cut. Parallel to the bones, English style.
Uh-huh.
Or rectangles of meat sitting on top of a single bone. I never even noticed that, and I've cooked my whole life.
No, I knew there were different recipes because I make Charlie Palmer's short ribs, and he wants them not the English cut. The other way with a chunk on top of a bone is exactly what he says you're supposed to go get.
Yeah, but she likes the English cut.
So there you go. Well, there's room for everybody, I guess. Room for everybody to have an opinion.
Oh, you should try those short ribs. They're so good.
Let's do the short ribs, shall we?
Do the thing. Well, next time I can buy short ribs, we will.
Okay, great.
But you keep on saying you want fish. you don't like solid, meaty stuff like short ribs, otherwise I'd get it all the time. No, I do need a rabbit recipe.
A rabbit recipe?
There's not one in this book,
isn't there one in there?
No.
No rabbit recipes?
No, really? I'm making one on... I'm starting a new book now.
Oh, thank goodness.
There's one dish we do with rabbit. It's called rabbit strozzapreti. Basically, it's basically...
Pre-taps.
Seared rabbit with pasta, but it's braised rabbit, actually. But it's braised with olives and rosemary.
That's great.
Oh, yeah. My God, it's so delicious.
Now, I mean, you are known for your silky pastas. What is the secret for making silky pasta?
I think it's the thinness of the pasta, and I think I'm such a moody person sometimes that I, you know, some days I make pasta and it has 20 eggs in it, some days I make it and it has two whole eggs and 40 yolks, you know, it just, so I always tend to fool around with the pasta, but I believe that it just really has to be beautiful and rolled out to the perfect perfect consistency, so it should be like just like a silk scarf. Like, you know when you want to have a beautiful scarf that just drapes around your neck? It should feel like that.
There you go. I mean, I can imagine you walking around South Boston with a with a scarf of fresh pasta around your neck.
No, I don't think that would work too well here.
But you have a lot just in your fingertips, though, Barbara, I think.
Yeah, but I also think it's like any craft. You just keep on making it, and you're going to make it to how you like it. You'll get so used to it.
Well, we're certainly enjoying this book, and listeners, I think you'll find this a lot of traditional items, but not traditionally to the letter made, which adds a lot of excitement to these flavors, Barbara. Uh-huh. And I even like the picture of the pasta on the cover rolled around a fork with the sauce. And it looks like a meat sauce, a bolognese. Mm-hmm. What is it?
Yes, that's the bolognese sauce.
Yeah, which you're also famous for.
Yep.
Maybe by the time this interview airs, we will have met you in person in New York for the James Beard Awards, where we're headed this weekend. I'm sure you'll be there. So we'll look out for you. Perhaps you can look out for us.
Yeah, we'll be in the press room, so you know what we look like.
Right.
So, well, okay.
All right.
Love the interview, love the book, and I'm dying to go to your new restaurant. It sounds just gorgeous.
Can't wait to have you here.
Okay.
Barbara Lynch, thank you. Go get him. Huh?
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Barbara. Oh, and now it's time for a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We have captured our next guests. We had to chase around a lot because they move a lot, don't they?
Well, they're busy guys. They own five or six different restaurants and a bakery, and all traveling under the name of Blue Ribbon Restaurants. And they're not they're not bargain priced establishments, but they're establishments where you can get good, healthy, solid, traditional kinds of foods. They told us that they make the best Reuben in New York City. And we were going to try and check that out, but we didn't do that yet.
Why didn't I get that Reuben?
It turned out we lost, our email to them got lost in their spam blocker.
I see.
And by the time they got back to us, it was too late to put into our schedule.
The restaurant was known as a chef's hangout. And so that tells you something.
So let's hear what they had to say.
Right. As an only child, I am totally astounded at the kind of close relationship siblings can have. We're talking to Bruce and Eric Bromberg. How long have you worked together?
We've been, that's an interesting question. The actual business relationship has been about 18 years.
Wow.
But even as kids, we created and built and made things. So we've kind of been in the same situation, since we can remember.
And which one was this? This was Bruce or Eric?
That was Bruce.
Okay, Bruce, Eric.
And the book is called The Blue Ribbon Cookbook, and the restaurant series, is at Blue Ribbon Restaurants, and you're known in ensemble as the Bromberg Brothers. What's the age difference?
I am 4.5 years older than Bruce.
Oh, that's a long time.
It is quite a bit.
Anyhow, let's start with, you decided to open your first restaurant when?
In 1991. And we actually opened in 1992.
I see.
With our original Blue Ribbon.
Now, you probably actually thought about it 20 years before that, too, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, and you did all the work yourself.
Bruce and I spent most of our childhood, as Bruce talked about earlier, building things together and making projects and everything from models to beakers and furniture and things like that. So when it came time to actually make our own restaurant, it seemed perfectly logical that we would jump in and do as much building as we could.
Now, cooking was in the family, right?
Both our dad's side and our mom's side. And our dad, from a very early age, I think when he did us a semester abroad in Europe, in France more particularly, he's always been really focused on food, and a lot of our childhood was spent traveling around and going on these fantastic culinary adventures with our dad. And from our mom's side, our grandmother was a really terrific cook, and we lived very close to her. She was in Passaic, New Jersey, and we were in Morristown, New Jersey, so we spent a lot of our holidays kind of watching Grandma cook, and that trickled down through Mom as well.
And she used schmaltz. I saw your book.
Exactly. It was very traditional.
Do you remember that? I mean, the pot of schmaltz. I just can't believe that we did that.
Everything was very exact, and she really made beautiful food.
Now, you were professionally trained.
Both of us, Eric before me, a few years before me, but we both trained in Paris at Le Cordon Bleu.
Okay. Now, obviously, this cookbook is the focus here, but you're going to give us the genesis of the cookbook and the recipes, and I'll bet that traces us back to these restaurants.
Well, a lot of the recipes in this cookbook, and even in our restaurants, really come from memories, you know, childhood memories of food and things that really impressed us as we were growing up. And like I said, our dad took us on a lot of fantastic journeys, which always involved food in great restaurants. And then our time spent in France, which was probably, you know, the most inspirational and most relevant cooking experiences we had. But the France and I think the basics of cooking that we learned at Cordon Bleu and in Paris are really the foundation of really all the recipes.
Well, I don't want to simplify things because that's really unfair. But if I were to categorize it as I read the book, it seems a lot like comfort food meets France in a way, because there's some solid core values that you would find in a northern New Jersey diner. But at the same time, you have a fabulous technique associated with all the ingredients and all the things you learned at Le Cordon Bleu.
Yeah, I think the way that came together the most was that we had all these fantastic experiences growing up with the tastes of northern New Jersey and the Northeast, really. And we didn't really have any culinary skill or knowledge as to how to prepare any of the dishes. We just had the idea of them and the taste, and we kind of carried forth that taste and that comfort, I guess, within us until we got into cooking French food. And we had, you know, a series of aha moments where we said, hey, that's probably how this dish was prepared, or that's how we could do that dish. And that way we kind of built our childhood memories with the French basics as we learned those techniques.
Now, you've got a whole lot of fans. If you flip over the book, if Anne flips over the book,
you
have some rather interesting ladies and gentlemen who are devotees of your restaurant.
Now, the one I didn't get was Lance Armstrong. I didn't know he was a foodie.
Well, he's actually, we're huge fans of him. So,
oh, I see.
And he's come to the restaurant a number of times, and he is. You know, he is a foodie, and it was great that he said something nice about us.
Yeah, just to go through the list, you have Lance Armstrong, Tony Bourdain, Billy Bush, Bobby Flay, Mario Batali, Julianna Margulis, and Tom Colicchio, just on the back cover.
Well, these, you know, a lot of the chef guys that are listed there, and there's others too, but when we opened in 1992, and we kind of became this late-night restaurant and really developed kind of the late-night scene in New York City.
Because there wasn't any, so
there really wasn't
chef.
Any. That's very true.
Right.
There were diners, and there were places where the chefs had gone home, and there were a couple guys in the kitchen making fries and a steak and a salad or an overcooked burger, whatever the case may be. But when we started doing this, it really resonated with the chef community, and every night, and still to this day, it's just a great environment, and, you know, we all kind of grew up together and learned the industry together, and, you know, it was a lot of years ago, but we're still doing it today.
Now, I think we should give some credit to Melissa Clark, who's been a guest on the show, but she has contributed a lot to this book.
Bruce and I have had the idea of writing a book for a good portion of our 18 years in business. It certainly took Melissa and her both effort and expertise and understanding to get a book written, and she was extraordinary.
Now, it's structured, it's a rather structured thing in terms of the order in which things appear, but it's filled with wisdom. I forget now the words that you used to describe.
I think we call it blue ribbon wisdom.
Blue ribbon wisdom. Okay, so what's with blue ribbon wisdom?
Well, I think that was actually a really big part of Melissa's input, too. But we would sit down every day for quite some time. This book took almost, well, 3 years plus, I think, actually. But
that's
we would
good.
Sit there. Yeah, not so bad. But she had a baby, and my wife had a baby, so there, a lot happened in those 3 years. But we would talk about recipes, and we'd get really into the nitty-gritty of how to simplify recipes in our style of cooking and, you know, what we've learned all these years in the kitchen. And after a while, she looked at us and she said, you guys, you have so many great tips that she felt would really resonate with the home cook and maybe even more adventurous cook. So she said, and we really love the concept because we do like thinking about all these things really in depth. She said, we need to have these little points throughout the book that highlight these tips and tricks and ideas and ways to make things easier so people can be successful at home cooking.
Now, this is aimed for the home cook. So, listeners, with this book, you're going to be able to make all this fantastic food. And I looked through it. I mean, it's doable, all of them.
You know, you hear a lot that, oh, this is a simple version of this, and this is a simple book. And sometimes you get it home, and you look at the first recipe, and you just have no idea what half the words are or how you would possibly make it, or even what it is. And we're really attracted in a way to simple familial cooking. It's where it all began for us, and it's really a huge part of what Blue Ribbon is. So we did make this, and even in our restaurants, our goals are always to simplify things, to get to the essence of the flavor. So I think that's what we do in this book, and I think, like you say, just browsing through, you feel like you can make every recipe in this book.
Now, I have two questions, actually. You mentioned your restaurants, and I want to get back to that so you can outline what these restaurants are. But I wanted to know, how did you evolve a singular cooking style with two different personalities?
That's an interesting question, but we have, honestly, we have spent so much of our life together, talking, communicating, working together, learning together, and doing projects together, that we essentially share ideas, and we're not twins, but we have some of the characteristics of twins where we can essentially know what each other's thinking.
So you sort of essentially finish off each other's sentences?
We do, and we may have actually done that already in this interview.
I think you might have, but I can't tell which of you is which because you sound so much alike.
We talk about our ideas and our theories and our philosophies a lot. So as we're developing and as we're trying and when we cook behind the scenes, we really share ideas, and sometimes we do disagree, and then we work our way to a point where we both feel comfortable that it's the right decision. And then in the aspect of the restaurants, we then share that information with our staff, our chefs, and so forth and so on. So we do everything possible to have a singular, unified front.
Well, you know, I see you're photographing here, and I must say you're both very cute, and you look like you're really nice guys.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That wasn't photo retouched or anything.
No.
Now, do all the restaurants serve the same menu?
No.
No, they don't. Well, let's move on to that. I didn't know the answer to that.
So.
I
mean,
really, it's funny because when Eric and I were kids, we would sit there and we'd talk about restaurants. Where one of our big focuses, our dad used to take us to Benihana when we were very young.
Oh, I remember that too. Yeah.
That really got us focused on having a restaurant someday.
Wasn't that fun as a kid watching them chop and stuff?
And to us, that just the whole kind of theater of food is a very exciting thing. But we always talked about we have to make the best version of this and the best version of that, and how cool would it be to make a great Chinese restaurant or a great Japanese restaurant. So when we started making, I guess almost that transition from our first restaurant to our second restaurant, we went from a kind of, an American-based restaurant with some French technique, but really an American-style restaurant, eclectic, a lot of different things going on. Our second restaurant is a Japanese restaurant.
Uh-huh.
So we've really kind of jumped all over the place. But what we do is we cook food that inspires us, and there's a lot of different things that inspire us. So then we went on to make a bakery, and since then we've done a wine bar and a sushi bar with a grill, and now even a bowling alley out in Brooklyn. So,
a bowling alley?
Yes.
What did you do there?
Yeah, we have a really great project that we did about a year ago, which is a great, fun restaurant with 16 bowling lanes and a music venue.
Oh, that's fabulous.
Well, now, there must be a central place where people can find out about all these places.
BlueRibbonRestaurant.com.
Plural. Restaurants, plural.
Yeah, restaurants is plural.
You also have other products. You have Naked Nuggets.
Yeah, Naked Nuggets are our answer to good food for kids. And actually, we started out making food for kids, and it turned out we have enormous amounts of non-kids who were very fanatical supporters. But when we started having children, and Bruce and I would go to kids' birthday parties and those types of things, we'd see, hey, wait a minute, every kid is eating either breaded chicken strips and french fries, or breaded chicken nuggets and french fries, or pizza
terrible,
and french fries.
Isn't it hard to cut the fingers off the chickens and off the fish?
You know, you need a lot of fingers to
you
make one of
those.
You
need a lot of fingers, don't you?
So,
well, you know, the thing is, though, did you read that wonderful book called Mad Hungry?
No.
The foodie who's trying to train his, he was so excited about sharing his culinary interest with his newborn, and it tracks through to about age three, and it's hysterical, because you know they change one week
well,
to the next.
Our real goal was just to give a healthy, good option, and we feel really strongly about the product, and we're kind of, now we're in a couple hundred stores across the nation, and it's really catching on, but it's kind of a category-changing product, because we've gotten rid of the frying and the breading, and really the number one kid food in the world, we're giving parents an option for it. So we're really excited about the Naked Nuggets.
Well, I'm sure you'll be up to something in the future. If you got up to 12 restaurants already and food for sale and a book, who knows what you might do next? Maybe you'll be on television next. Who can tell?
Who knows?
Are you not on television yet?
Not yet. We've done a lot of shows, and people have asked us to appear on a lot of shows, but we haven't done like our own show or anything.
Well, I bet we'll see you on the Today Show one of these days very soon, or maybe Good Morning America. Or
sure, we did. Yeah, we were on the Today Show a couple of weeks ago for the cookbook, and we'll be on Martha Stewart coming up in the next month in May.
Well, you're an absolutely fascinating pair. And
my one question is your Reuben recipe the very best Reuben sandwich in the world? That's my favorite thing in the world.
We'd love for you to try it, and you let us know.
Where do I go for that?
Blue Ribbon Bakery is the one in the West Village, or you can just get the book and make it at home.
No, it's not funny if you have to make it. I'm thinking that we would satisfy Anne's craving for the best Reuben in New York City when we're in New York in just a couple of weeks. So we'll drop you a note and see if we can't get connected. And in the meantime, Eric and Bruce, thank you so much for joining us on the menu, and you can go back to whatever each of you are doing in New Jersey and New York.
All right. Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you both. It's been fun really talking to you.
You too. It was great. Thanks so much.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
And now it's time to pause again for some commercial info.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And here we are again, and we launch into our final segment.
Yeah, it's the French Connection.
It's the French Connection.
Although that's not immediately apparent, because our first guest, Susan Loomis, talks a lot about nuts, but it turns out she talks a lot about nuts calling us from France, where she has a cooking school and has been living for more than 10 years that she lived in France before. I guess she likes it there, and there's an interesting international flavor about everything she talks about. But nevertheless, the connection with France. And then our final interview is a really cute little book called Spécialité de la Maison, which is, I think, a reissue of a book that was written several decades ago, where it's not your conventional recipes. It's recipes contributed by people who either cooked them themselves or they cooked them for other people, and they were all famous people, people of stage and screen and society contributing to a charitable cause. And the author found this book and decided it needed updating and reissue, so she did that, and it's a fascinating little story all on its own.
Susan Herman Loomis, you have written a book that you said used to elicit giggles from people because it's a book about nuts. Why is that, that people giggle about nuts?
Well, this is becoming the most oft question about nuts in the kitchen, my new book, and I do not know the why. I don't know why North Americans think that nuts is such a hilarious subject, but they do.
Well, because of crazy.
Yeah, I think it's the play. I think it's the play on words.
I think that's probably it. But why do we call crazy people nuts? I don't know.
That is a tricky one.
Well, you better go to the Wikipedia on nuts, since you love nuts so much. I think it's up to you to find that out.
Susan, you've written 8 books, including 6 cookbooks, and you write all the time for the major food magazines, and you operate a school called Rue Tatin in Normandy, France. How did you enter on this track?
Well, it was a long time ago. I'll tell you, I have a degree in journalism, and I had a job at I worked at newspapers and worked in public relations, and I found myself reading about food constantly, and I thought, I really want to write about food. And so I thought I should learn to cook before I started writing about food, and that took me to France to be an apprentice at a cooking school.
Oh, so that's cool.
And I lived in Paris for 4 years, and then lived in the U.S. for 10, and then moved back to France in 1993.
And you've been there ever since?
I've been here ever since.
I guess you kind of like it.
I like it a lot.
So now, what gave you the inspiration to write a book about cooking with nuts?
Honestly, I read, there was a Swedish study done about the nutrition of nuts, and I've always been a big nut eater. We use a lot of nuts in France, in French cooking, and actually in most cultures, nuts are just an important part of the ingredient list. So I thought, you know, it's time to write a book about nuts, because Americans think of them as a guilty snack food, and are missing so much flavor, mostly, and nutrition also. So, and I thought it would be very fun. Because I'm a journalist, I love to travel and interview people. I thought, you know, I'm just going to do a tour of the world and just learn all about nuts and different cuisines. And I didn't do the whole world, but I did a part of it and loved every second of the research.
And you did seeds as well.
I did. Uh-huh. The seeds are included. You can't really talk about nuts without talking about seeds.
Right, and peanuts, which aren't nuts at all, right?
Not at all, but because we think of them as a nut, they enter into the family of nuts.
And again, they may not be nuts according to the genus, but they're certainly nuts in the way they're used.
Exactly. That's the thing. So it's almost not interesting to make the distinction because they're considered a nut by everyone.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's like tomatoes are a fruit, but we eat it like a vegetable.
Exactly.
And rhubarb, I guess, is the same way. It's a vegetable and we eat it like a fruit. So
right.
There are various crossovers, and certainly there's a crossover of nuts with just about everything, I guess.
Yeah, well, you start out, you give an overview of the various kinds of nuts and their nutritional value. But the thing I liked most is you started out with a definition, I guess, of what is a handful, because that's where many people go astray.
Well, they do, and somebody calibrated a handful of almonds, and it's, I believe it's 27. I don't actually have that page right in front of me, but the point being, a handful is generous, but it's not too much. And I think that once you start incorporating nuts into your diet, really, you will find that a handful of almonds or a handful of hazelnuts or walnuts or peanuts will keep you satisfied for hours. So that between meals, you won't be eating between meals as much. And that way, nuts end up being a really great way to keep your diet stabilized.
Well, I learned about that from my personal trainer, actually.
Well, it's not like it's a big secret, but it's just not something that's been talked about enough.
Yeah, but she eats a small handful of nuts every day. And she said it really fills you up. It keeps you going.
Well, you told me you were supposed to eat 4 almonds a day because it's either good luck or it's good health. I'm not sure which it is.
Oh, it's health.
probably should do more than 4, I guess.
There have been lots of rules and sort of stay away from things like that simply because I think I just want people to eat normally. You know, I don't want people to be saying, oh, my God, I have to have my handful. Oh, my goodness, I had 5 nuts instead of 3. You know, I think the point of this book is sort of to get nuts into the diet in a comfortable, natural way. And there are 100 recipes that I hope will encourage people to do that.
And they're very, very ingenious recipes. Delicious, creative, not your routine, nutritional, throw in a bunch of nuts kind of book. No, they're very inspiring.
Thank you. You know, I think visiting different cultures and seeing how people do use nuts as one of the panoply of ingredients really makes a difference, because it becomes less an artifice
right.
than just something very natural.
You have, what of all these recipes, what would you say would be your favorite find, big discovery that you didn't have before?
Oh, there's so many. You know, only my favorite recipes got into the book, so that's a tough one, but I love the hanger steak with walnuts and horseradish.
Oh, that's
I make
great.
That one actually a lot, and we make that in class, because it's a very creative use of nuts, meat, red wine. I love, there's a trout recipe with nuts that is absolutely fantastic, and that's
like
a
that
Swedish
one.
Inspiration.
Well, trout is one of the things that kind of, I've always had, I mean, sliced almonds have always been something that I guess went
right.
with trout.
Exactly.
Even in the boring British cuisine that I was brought up with, people knew that trout almondine was a way you were supposed to serve trout.
For some reason that I'm not certain why, but nuts and seafood have a natural affinity, and I think it's the buttery aspect of both of them, so that I have a recipe in the book for almonds, for mussels cooked with hazelnuts, and it's sublime.
Now, that sounds like something I could really do. I love that.
But you've gone way beyond just nuts with fish and that kind of thing. I mean, you have nuts in lots and lots of different kinds of main courses. Give us an idea of some of the things that perhaps are pairings of nuts and things that are a little bit unusual.
Well, I think most people wouldn't think about putting nuts on top of a pizza. And I have a recipe for focaccia with onions and almonds, and it just amazing. I have some savory breads that you can serve as an appetizer, or actually as a full course, as a main course at lunch with a salad, which incorporate almonds and hazelnuts and different nuts, any nut you want, really. Then I have a tomato and pistachio tart that I like to serve as a first course, but that, then again, you can make it as a main course. There's a wonderful side dish of pine nuts and red peppers where you roast the peppers and saute them in extra virgin olive oil and then add toasted pine nuts. There's
How about this parsnip and walnut fricassee?
Oh, that's a wonderful dish, wonderful dish. And the butternut squash and arugula salad that has seeds on top, it has a lot of pumpkin seeds on top, that is a main course vegetarian, even a vegan dish. And I wasn't really focusing on any particular dietary stricture. But in the end, there are a lot of recipes in this book that can be used by people who choose not to eat meat.
Yeah, I mean, nuts are a very important part of the vegan diet, right?
Well, because they are so full of good things. There's another recipe in here that's really great. It's not for the vegan, but it's shrimp biryani with cashews. And shrimp biryani is not necessarily the most original recipes, but I deconstructed it because I thought it's just such a gorgeous assemblage of different little recipes that make up a dish, and if people make this dish, they will love it.
I would like to just go through and cook every one of these recipes in this book.
Well, I hope you will.
Like lamb and apples with pistachios. Tell us
Middle Eastern.
Yeah, the pistachio. Tell us a little bit about the romance of the pistachio.
Well, I have a long history with pistachios personally because my father was a pilot in the U.S. Air Force, and he used to fly to Turkey and come back with huge bags of these gorgeous pistachios, and I got hooked on them as a child. And when we moved back to the U.S., I could never find the same satisfaction in a pistachio, and it took me till I moved to France. I went to a market and bought some, and I tasted that same flavor. And I learned these were Turkish pistachios, so when I started working on this book, I was bound and determined to go to Turkey and find out all about it, and I did. And I couldn't help but being romanced by the whole thing, because Turkey's a wonderful country. Eastern Turkey, Anatolia, is a very exotic place.
Oh, I love it.
And the pistachio orchards are just wonderful.
Now, we found a supplier of pistachios. Was it in New Mexico? Or was in an odd corner of this country.
Yeah, it was.
And they told us all about the tradition of, I guess it was dyeing pistachios that weren't very good, dyeing them red.
When their shells were blemished, they were dyed red. And I grew up eating red pistachios, and they never were as good as the ones I remembered. But I don't see red pistachios anymore, but then they might be in the U.S. We just don't have them here.
No, we did find a source. Somebody was farming them, and it was in New Mexico or Arizona or somewhere
in California. They farm them.
Okay, so maybe that's where it was, and they were just an excellent product. But you're right.
New Mexico.
Was it New Mexico? Mm-hmm. Okay, well then, so do Google pistachios in New Mexico. Maybe you'll find them there.
Yeah. Well, the thing about it is that many of these things are grown in small plots in many parts of the world. I mean, just the idea of going to Thailand and realizing so many families have their own peanut plot. They don't produce enough for the whole country. They have to import peanuts, but still, people who can grow their own.
Yeah. We encountered in Australia a macadamia nut grower, and that was interesting because I never thought of macadamia nuts aside from Hawaii.
They actually began in Australia, I believe,
yes,
and
yeah,
were
I
native.
I think that's made
their way to Hawaii, and now I believe the biggest producer is still Australia. Yeah. The Hawaii production isn't as big, but they're such a delicious nut.
We visited the guys. His macadamia nut plantation was really quite amazing.
Yeah, and his wife had these fabulous recipes for macadamia nut pesto. But
oh yeah,
who could afford it?
I've got a recipe in the book for a macadamia nut butter, and I'll tell you, it's wonderful.
You know, you have a section in this book I wanted to make sure to mention called Basics. Tell us about your basics.
Basics are all the little recipes that you will pull from to make other ones. And so, for instance, I have a wonderful mixture called gomazio that's toasted
right
sesame
at it.
Seeds and salts. I have a basic recipe to make nut butter. And it's so easy to make at home. There's almost no reason to buy it. You can use any nut. You just have to have some patience and a food processor. I have in this a savory or sweet almond sprinkle that you make with the almonds left over from making almond milk. And almond milk is very easy to make.
Yeah, tell me about almond milk. I mean, I keep reading about it all of a sudden. I don't remember having this many references to almond milk in the past.
I think as people become more and more allergic or turned off of cow's milk, they're searching for other kinds of milk. And almond milk is a natural because it's full of nutrition and it's really quite easy to make, or you can buy it. And once you do, you can basically substitute for cow's milk. You'll have to make some changes, but you take a cup and a half of raw almonds and you cover them with water and refrigerate overnight. Then you drain and place them in a blender and put them in a sieve and let them drain, and what comes out is almond milk. And you can use that in soups or desserts or drink it in your coffee. It's not fatty like cow's milk.
You know, we have a granddaughter who's allergic to cow's milk. I mean, it seems odd to me, but it brings up another thing. You mentioned nut allergies, and I mean, I witnessed now firsthand these pediatricians, the regulations on feeding children, and why do we all of a sudden have so many allergies, and particularly these nut allergies? And I mean, she was not allowed to have. I don't think she's allowed to have nuts still.
Nut allergies can be a serious thing. And why do we have so many allergies now? I have lots of... I'm a layperson. I'm not a doctor or scientist. But I have my reasons. I think we have lots of allergies. And
I'd like your opinion.
The chemicals used in the production of food for so many years have just made us very sensitive to so many different things. And in a way, much food is denatured so that what we think we're eating, we may not be eating. What we're eating is something that's either covered with chemicals or infused with some substance that our body just can't handle. I think pollution has weakened our defenses. I just think it's a whole. I mean, it's not any one thing. And I find, you know, I live in France, and where, of course, we have pollution too, but not as much, and food is so much cleaner, and we just don't have the allergies here.
Well, I see, I thought that all these regulations were part of the problem. How could you keep a child away from a particular food until after age 2 and then dump it on the child without getting a reaction?
Yeah, I think you shouldn't. I think, first of all, I believe that children should be nursed if the mother can do it, and that you know, there's just polemic about it all, but the more refined our food is and the more we limit what we eat, the more sensitive we become.
I agree. Well, Susan, have you written a book on apples yet?
Not yet. I haven't.
But you're right there.
What a good idea. I'm right here.
You're right there.
We have hundreds of varieties of apples right within 10 kilometers of where I live.
It's been great talking to you.
Thank you.
I'm hoping people will actually explore this book, buy it, and use it, because it's a wonderful source of nutrition that they haven't only scratched the surface of.
Yeah. And I just wanted to mention that I have a blog that's called nutsinthekitchen.com, and the title of the book is Nuts in the Kitchen.
Great.
There we go. Well, I want to give you a little project before you go, although you may know these people already. We had a wonderful product on the show called Tea for Two, which is fruit preserves made in Normandy.
Oh, I don't. Well, I don't know. I might know these people.
By an American couple who took over, I think it was her family's orchard.
And, wonderful.
And they were English.
They were English.
Okay. And the one lived in France. The other one lived in New York.
And they had a friend.
They
had
best
a friend.
Friends.
They had a friend who worked for the United Nations in the U.S. So they called her up and said, "Would you please help us market your product in the United States?"
Wonderful. I'll look them up.
It's fabulous. They're fabulous.
Sure if you Google tea for two, you'll find them.
I bet I will. Well, thank you so much for the tip.
Oh, it's really a great product. I had forgotten about that, Rabbit. You have such
a
good
memory. Yeah, I remember things except where I last put my car keys and my wallet.
Well, Susan,
well,
it's been
so
great meeting you.
I appreciate it. I'll look forward to getting the link and the information.
Great. You will do that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Susan. Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
A France-born Christine Schwartz Hartley has written the preface to a very interesting book called Specialité de la Maison.
Well, I listened to that French accent, huh?
Yeah. And Christine, tell us about this book. What is it? What made it come about?
Well, Specialité de la Maison is a reprint of a cookbook that was put together in 1940 and had a new edition in 1949. It was put together for the American Friends of France, which was a war relief organization that basically worked to help the French population during the war. And American Friends of France was headed by Anne Morgan, a formidable woman. She was the youngest daughter of J. Pierpont Morgan.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and she was a great Francophile, a really deep Francophile, because she had spent so much time in France vacationing with her parents. She had other ties to France. And so when she had started a war relief effort for France during the First World War, and now she came back to the U.S., did a lot of other philanthropic good deeds in the U.S., and then feeling war coming in 1939, she said, it's time to restart my war relief effort, and she called on all her friends. She was extremely well connected, not only because of her family, but also of the friends she'd made when she was a young woman in the theater. She made friends in the theater. She wasn't in theater. So she called on all her wide network of friends to contribute recipes to a book, which she used as a fundraising tool for American Friends of France.
So we have now a collection of recipes by noteworthy writers, celebrities, socialites of the day, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was very impressed. The foreword is by famous or infamous issue, Graydon Carter, who's a very, very interesting man.
Yes.
And also the cover was by an artist who actually illustrated one of my favorite books, Goodnight Moon, which all kids all grew up with.
Yes, no, it's wonderful. This is an almost exact replica of the 1940 cover, and Graydon Carter was incredibly generous to me because I'm a nobody. He doesn't know me, of course. I know him, but when I got the okay to go ahead with this book and the contract to do the biography, my editor said, you know, we have to get a blurb for this book because nobody knows you. And so we toyed around with ideas, and I said Graydon Carter would be just fabulous because he's at this nexus of high society and entertainment, sort of the equivalent of the contemporary equivalent of the crowd that's featured in this book. And he himself has now become a restaurateur because owns the Monkey Bar in New York and Minetta Taverns in the West Village. And so I just sent him a copy of the book, and I said, dear Mr. Carter, you know, I would so much appreciate for you to blur my book, you know, for those reasons I just told you about.
Yeah.
And he came back to me, and he so loved it, he said, oh, I'll do a foreword. And it's brilliant.
Oh, yes.
I'm very, very blessed and grateful.
Now, this is a somewhat unusual cook. This is not really a cookbook done by chefs. This is a cookbook done by people who just happen to be quite well-known and also happen to cook.
Yes.
Can you explain?
Well, who are some of the contributors?
The contributors, there's J. Charlie Chaplin, Elizabeth Arden, Helen Keller, which makes a lot of people laugh, but she could do anything.
Uh-huh.
Eleanor Roosevelt, Mrs. Cole Porter, Norma Scherr, Mary Pickford, Laurence Olivier.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Katharine Hepburn, Aldous Huxley, Pearl Buck, Noel Coward, I never pronounce it right.
Yeah.
Vivien Leigh, Cecil Beaton, Tallulah Bankhead, and Mrs. Astor, Mrs. Vincent Astor, which at the time was his second wife.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also Mrs. Brooke Marshall, became Vincent Astor's third and last wife.
Uh-huh.
Very interesting. There is no truth to the rumor that there is a recipe in here for burnt toast.
No.
Oh, that was supposed to be a joke. I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry.
That one obviously went over everybody's head.
Yeah, especially mine, because despite having an Australian husband, I just, for 16 years, I'm not. I don't get all the Anglo humor.
No, that's perfectly obvious. Anne didn't laugh either, so
no.
maybe it wasn't all that funny.
Well, I'm not really very interested in toast. Christine, this
yes.
is a little far afield from what you usually do. I mean, you're a writer specializing in architecture and design,
yeah.
and a translator,
yeah.
obviously, from French to English, and with some great credits to on your resume. Whatever led you to this book, this facsimile revival of this book?
Well, it was precisely because I was no longer getting any work from my usual sources, the Al Decor and Interior Design and Book Forum, in the fall of 2008. And they were not calling me. I was pitching to them. They were not responding. And I was really, really getting worried. But I didn't realize that I was beginning to feel the impact of the recession on my line of work. I was just thinking, what's happened? Nobody loves me anymore. And so I made a new friend who is a dealer in rare and out-of-print books. And I just decided, and he specializes in interior design, architecture, photography, fashion, the lives of and the rich and famous. And so I said, Bill, can I come and visit you and see if in your stock I find something that will give me an idea that will make magazines respond. And he showed me a lot of things, and then he said, oh, you're French, you'll like this book. And he was Spécialité de la Maison, and I could not believe it.
Well, it's the vintage recipes, too. I'm not sure many people are going to be cooking from the book, but...
Oh, no, I disagree.
Oh, really? Okay, tell me that. Tell me what you think.
No, some recipes are shocking to today's taste and obsession with diet because they feature a lot of cream, a lot of sauces, a lot of fat, but they are eminently doable. I've been cooking from the book, and I look forward to cooking many more things. Vivien Leigh's recipe for filet of sole Véronique, she has a French title. You know, I'm not a great cook at all, but I followed her recipe to the letter, and it came out great.
It's amazing.
Really good.
Now, maybe she cooked that for Laurence Olivier. Now, what did Laurence cook for her?
Laurence, actually, he's right the page before. Oh, yeah. Laurence Olivier has a recipe for moule farci. So it's stuffed mussels,
right.
Yes.
And then we have Tallulah Bankhead's recipe for southern fried chicken.
Yes. I haven't tried that. What I'm looking forward to is cooking the Duc de Verdura's tomato and clam recipe. I'm a big fan of fish because I like both of those ingredients. And the Duc de Verdura was a great jewelry maker.
Huh.
And his name persists, Verdura. And he had gotten his first break at Coco Chanel studio in Paris, where Cole Porter met him. because Cole Porter and his wife lived in Paris for a while. And I think it was from Cole Porter's to tell Verdura to go to New York. And for Chanel, Verdura had created the crosses that are such a trademark of the Chanel. But to come back to whether the recipes are usable or not, I could point to many.
No, I'm sure that they are. I was just saying that there's another interest level besides just another cookbook, and you seem to be an expert on the dish behind all these dishes, all these celebrities, yeah. And that's the fun of it.
That's what drew me to this book, honestly, because I told you I'm not a great cook. I love eating, but, you know, my husband is a much better cook than I am. But that's what drew me to this book, was the incredible crowd, the very scintillating and varied array of people who contributed recipes, and the story behind the book. It really touched me, being French, that this book had come about in an effort to help the French population in times of war. So for me, it represents also a time during which France and America were better friends than they are now.
We better not go that way, I suspect. This is an absolutely charming book. I'm sure it's going to make its impact on the entente cordiale between the U.S. and France. Let's hope so. And if not, anyway, it's a great book, and listeners, I think you'll be fascinated to have a copy.
Wow, thank you very much.
Yeah, Christine, and I'm sure everybody would like to sit down in a corner with you over a glass of wine and just talk about all these characters, because that's really a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun.
Yeah. So thank you so much for coming on the menu.
Thank you
And keep us posted on your next project.
Okay, I will.
Thanks, Christine. Bye-bye. Okay. Well, we accomplished everything we said we would in this program, and I think that wraps it.
As they say in the profession, that's a wrap.
That's
same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.